Hi, I'm Channing.
And I'm Elise.
And this is the Faithful Feminist Podcast.
But this is not just any Come Follow Me podcast. We do things a little differently here. We offer approachable feminist interpretations of the Come Follow Me manual for those who want to study and understand the scriptures in a framework of equality, social justice, and sisterhood. We are here to show you all the really good ways faith and feminism work together to illuminate and deepen the gospel experience.
We've saved you a seat on the soft chairs, so join us today for a conversation about Alma chapters 43 through 52 for the dates August 3rd through the 9th. We're so glad you're here.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm so glad to have Channing back.
Woohoo!
For this week's episode, and we need each other because there are literally so many chapters to cover, and this is one of the things that we have talked about, at least behind the scenes. Channing and I are always like, why is the Come Follow Me manual organized the way that it is?
Yeah, it's like some weeks we only cover like two or three chapters, and then other weeks, like, remember that one in 2 Nephi was like 11 chapters. It's literally like trying to drink from a fire hose. It's a lot.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we felt initially, or at least that's how I felt initially approaching these chapters, especially because this is where we start to see a lot of the infamous war chapters unfolding here. There's a lot of stories going on, lots of characters, and a lot of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is definitely can be sometimes a difficult story to follow because I feel like it just comes at you really fast as you're reading. You're just like you kind of get sucked into the text and you're like, whoa, and then that happened, and then this happened, and then that happened. But if you ask me right now, like literally just before we got on to record, Elise was like, if you asked me where all of the stuff was, like chapter-wise, I wouldn't be able to tell you because it's a lot. But we're going to cover it today as best and excitedly as we can because there's a lot of goodness to pull from these chapters. So right at the beginning of these chapters, we start in chapter 43. There are some verses that I find kind of interesting, but also a little bit funny because they just seem really out of place. And so these verses are chapter 43, verses 2 and 3. And these are written by Mormon, not by Alma. I think they were put in afterwards because they kind of carry the voice of a narrator. So these verses say, "Now we shall say no more concerning Alma and his sons' preaching, except that they preach the word and the truth according to the spirit of prophecy and revelation. And now I return to an account of the wars between the Nephites and the Lamanites in the 18th year of the reign of the judges." And as I was reading, I was like, wait, what? isn't this supposed to be like the Book of Mormon? Isn't this supposed to be a record of things that are only sacred? And I kind of was trying to remember, like, wasn't that a thing? Like, didn't Nephi say that when he first was writing on the plates? And so I went back, tried to find the verse, and it's in 1 Nephi chapter 19. He basically records a commandment from the Lord and says that the only things that should be written on the plates that comprise the Book of Mormon, they should be reserved for, quote, "the ministries, prophecies, and the more plain and precious parts," and that the other set of plates that Nephi made records on were meant for, quote, "the wars and contentions and destructions of my people." And Nephi even goes as far as to say, "I don't write anything upon plates save it be that I think it's sacred." And you can find this in verses 3 through 6. And that's again in 1 Nephi chapter 19. So I just find it really interesting that Mormon, who's abridging these plates and making them a little bit easier for us to all read, he compiles them in the spirit of Nephi. So I think it's interesting to note that these war chapters all of a sudden are contained in a record that's supposed to be saved for like spiritual things only. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I guess I'm a little bit curious about that. Why would that be the case if war chapters are suddenly more important or hold more weight or value in a text when the text makes it very explicit that Alma and his sons went out to preach a ton. Like, that was their whole entire job. And we're just missing, like, all of the things that they said. So I find that really interesting. Any thoughts, Elise?
I think Mormon is super, super, like, thinks Moroni is the most fantastic person ever. So it would make sense that, like, Mormon wants to spend lots of time, like, telling and teaching us how amazing Moroni is. And also, it seems like these wars go on for long, long periods of time. And if that's kind of the event that's taking up the most of people's time, I think it would almost be, I don't know. I'm just thinking that, like, they were feeling like this was an important piece to talk about, especially because the Nephites were on the defensive side and they were being attacked, and they saw so clearly God in their motivations to go to war that I think that they found God even in war. Mm-hmm. And that could be one reason why they feel it's important and maybe sacred to write on the plates. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I just find it really interesting. I almost wish that, like, the Book of Mormon could have been a little bit longer. Like, could we also include everything that Alma taught? Like, why do we have to do this either or? But, like, maybe they didn't even write it down. Like, maybe Alma didn't write it down. Who knows? But I also think that it's important as a feminist reader to pay attention to what content in the book receives the most weight and value in the abridgment that Mormon made. And I do find it interesting and it's not even just in the Book of Mormon, but across all of sacred texts, that wars and battle and contention and violence are talked about quite a bit. And I have to wonder if it's just partly because men wrote the record. And so I often wonder, probably like a lot of other feminist readers do, how different would the scriptures look and how different would these accounts of war look if they had been written and recorded by women? We will never know.
And I think oftentimes, even in the beginning of the Come Follow Me manual, it kind of says something like, you might find these chapters difficult to relate to, but there are important lessons here or something. And I think that's exactly how I felt approaching this set of scriptures. And I was kind of like, ugh, there are no women here. Like, the women aren't fighting. Like, this is kind of pointless. But after slowing down, the reason these people are going to battle is for the least of these. They're fighting for their land, their children, and their women.
Yeah, that was one thing that stuck out to me too as we were reading, and I was like, yay, finally women aren't being thrown in the fire.
Yeah. And I'm there's sorry. No, that's exactly it. And there was a passage that I had found from a Mormon Women Project article by Neelan McBlain. They write, so it seems that Mormon's goal to make sure that the readers know that the gruesome actions he's describing were motivated by a desire to defend wives, children, and families. It feels here like a welcome antidote to the sacrifice of Ammonihahite women and children in Alma chapter 14. Instead of being tossed aside in the work of death, women are instead here positioned as being worthy of protection at all cost. And I think that pairs up really nicely to what you literally had just said about, wow, the women and children aren't just being tossed into the fire. They are worthy of protection here.
Yeah, I almost wonder if, like, I don't know. I don't want to say, like, oh, the Nephites learned their lesson, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, like, also maybe they kind of did. And I do find this comparison between the actions of defending the women and children to the events that happened in Ammonihah. And especially if we get a little further in the text, one of the sites of battle that happens in these war chapters actually happens in Ammonihah.
Right.
And the text says that the Nephites have rebuilt the city, and Moroni went to special effort to fortify the city to make sure that it was going to be absolutely impossible to overtake it. And the Lamanites didn't know this. And so the text even says they went to Ammonihah, assuming that because they were able to overtake it once, that it would be easy for them to do it again. And so the Lamanites arrived to Ammonihah to find it exactly how Moroni planned, incredibly fortified and impossible to overtake. So the Lamanites don't even try. Like, they just look at that and they're like, yeah, nope, hard pass. And what I find so – I was actually really touched reading this section of scripture because I thought, oh my gosh, what a relief to have this site, this city that was a place of such horrific violence against women, to not have to see more violence and bloodshed. No one died. There was literally no bloodshed at this, quote, Battle of Ammonihah. And I just found it a huge relief, almost like a little bit of a tender mercy in the text of like, thank goodness. Like, sometimes the land and the people already suffered too much. And I'm just so glad, almost in some way, that like, not that that event of women and children being thrown into the fire is redeemable. I'm sure some people won't agree with me, but I kind of think that it's not. Mm-hmm. But to see that there was some kind of attempt made and maybe some kind of divine intervention made to make sure that that was not a site of violence again. I just was really touched by it, and I was really, really grateful for that little bit of relief in these kind of violent chapters.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when Alma had gone to Ammonihah, there was – and you can all listen to the episode we did where we critiqued the patriarchy and the toxic masculinity that we felt showed up in that event at Ammonihah. And so at that event, they didn't choose to stand by the women. They were absolutely – they were objects that were easily disposable. Mm-hmm. And if we compare that to what's happening now, these women and children and the land are worthy of protection, but not in a type of like – or I wouldn't want to read it as, oh, women and children, like, you're too weak. Like, you need to stay at home. Like, we'll that type of protectionist mindset, I feel like, especially in the 21st century – as feminists, we're trying to move away from that, that like we are equal participants, but it's the women and the children and the families and the land that are at risk. Those are the ones that need allies. They need people to fight for them. It doesn't mean that they're sitting home passively and doing nothing. I'm sure that they are equally engaged in the work, but it looks different at that time. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of women that show up in these texts. It's the wives and the children of the Nephites that they're going to fight for, that they are trying to save and honor and protect. Then later in chapters 47 and 52, we have the appearance of the Lamanite queen. And then in chapter 50, we see a maidservant appear, and she plays a pretty big role in bringing peace and justice to the war.
And anytime that we see women explicitly mentioned in the text, we're always like, oh my gosh, finally. Like, here they are. And even though their stories are complicated and complex, we really wanted to spend some time digging into those stories and talking about them so that we can see the women that show up in these stories. One of the main female characters that we see show up in the text, just like Elise mentioned, was the Lamanite queen. And we see her show up in chapter 47, and she's kind of showing up in the middle of a lot of like action that's happening in the battlefield. So there was a man named Amalickiah who was once a Nephite, but decided that he didn't like everything that was going on in the Nephite community, probably because he was a jerk. That's at least how he comes across in the text. He goes to the Lamanite army and essentially like works his way up the leadership in the Lamanite army and eventually kills the chief, the head of the Lamanite army. He poisons him little bit by little bit, right? So once he becomes head of the Lamanite army, he decides that that's just not enough. He wants a little bit more. So he goes to the king of the Lamanites. The king of the Lamanites comes out to meet Amalickiah out in like the field somewhere. And while the king and Amalickiah are out there, Amalickiah's servants just stab the king and like kill him right on the spot. And the servants of the king see this happen and they're like freaking out. And all of a sudden Amalickiah is like, you guys, you all just saw the king's servants kill the king. Like, if any of you people who are here love the king, then chase down those servants and, like, make them pay for this evil act that they did. All well knowing that the people who were close and right there were, like, his, like, inside men, right? So they are the only ones. Them and the servants, the king's servants, are the only ones that know that Amalekai actually killed the king. So these servants run away, and eventually word makes it back to the queen that her husband has died, and Amalekiah's armies are marching to her land. And so the text says in chapter 47, and these are in verses 32 through 35, the queen sent word to Amalekiah and, quote, desired him that he would spare the people of the city and bring witnesses to testify concerning the death of the king, her husband. And so Amalekiah was probably like, sure, yeah, this is my plan all along. So he goes there and talks to the queen and basically says, like, look, here are my witnesses. They all saw the servants kill the king. And look, the servants have run away. Like, is there any more proof that you need of their guilt? And the text basically says, and thus they satisfied the queen concerning the death of the king. Then, like, this all happens in three verses, right? Like, there's not a lot of time between all of this. And then the text says in verse 35, Amalekiah sought the favor of the queen and took her unto him to wife. For me personally, reading this text, I'm like, oh, how very suspicious. Like, of course he sought her favor and took her unto him to wife. But I, just as a woman myself reading the text, I'm not entirely sure that she was actually convinced. You know, like, women aren't dumb. And so, like, if a man came to me and was like, oh, yeah, the servants, the ones that you know, the ones that, like, you probably have a relationship with and see every single day, those are the ones that killed the king. This was their first opportunity, right? Like, right when mm-hmm. I showed up. And I'm just very suspicious of this whole thing. I don't actually think the queen believed him. I also think or wonder if she really had a whole lot of choice in the matter as far as, like, marrying Amalekiah. Because if you think about it, her first request to Amalekiah was, please spare the people of the city. So obviously she cared a little bit about her duties and about her people. And I imagine too that she had children with the king, and she was probably concerned for their safety too. And so I feel a little bit sad reading this story about the queen, because I just can imagine the circumstances being pretty treacherous. And honestly, I'm not sure that she did have another choice as far as, like, trying to do the best by her people and the best by her children. I mean, because she could have, like, what, said no? And then Amalekiah would have slowly poisoned her and her children anyway, just like he did with the chief in the, like, the head leader of the Lamanite armies. Like, I guess I'm just kind of feeling frustrated that this was her only option, but also, like, really compassionate, understanding that this probably was her only option. And so I just feel sad. That probably was not a happy or healthy or good arrangement. I don't know, Elise, what do you think?
No, I think you've said it as generously and as compassionately as we can read into this story. I'm also thinking, if she said, no, Amalekiah, I don't want to marry you, I agree that he probably would have freaked the heck out and killed her anyways, and maybe she knew that. But also, like, what if she wanted to continue to hold the power that she did hold? I think that meant that she needed to remarry anyway. Like, I don't know enough about Lamanite governmental structures to know if when the king dies, does the queen reign in his stead, or is right. there a new king that she has to marry, or does she get, like, kicked out altogether and the king's brother, like, steps up? I don't know what that looks like, but I do trust that she wasn't just tricked. I think that she was awake and aware to the situation and was hopefully acting out of not just self-preservation, but also, I don't know, maybe she tried to do good with the power that she did hold. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Malachi is a super bad guy, though, or at least he's painted that way in the text. So I don't know what their what role she played in the ways that Amalekiah like made decisions, but he basically ran a solo show, so I don't think he would really care about what she had to say anyways. So
no. Yeah.
I don't know. That's all to say. It's just kind of, it's sad, but I don't think that she was tricked. I think she knew what was going on.
Right. I also just want to make some commentary. As I was doing research for this episode, I came across a couple of things that people had written in commentaries on this story, basically saying that the queen was in on it and that she wanted her husband to die and she was like excited and ready to marry Amalekiah. And I think I'm also a little bit bugged or concerned by those because I'm like, oh, really? You think she had that much say and that much power? I mean, not that it's like totally impossible, right? But the circumstances and the way that their interlude is worded just in these three verses, like I feel like it doesn't really point to that. And also our understanding of women and the power structures that they're living in at the time don't really lend themselves to that type of, I don't know, like coup. Is that what you call it? Yeah. Like, I mean, it is possible, but it's not plausible. So I would take any time that – this is totally going to bug my husband if he listens to this episode. But anytime I hear opinion pieces that try and make women out to be, like, conniving, mischievous, like, premeditated people, I'm always like, oh, who authored this opinion piece? Oh, yeah, it was a man.
I think that's the other thing, too. Like, it's – in the same way that we're being imaginative with what we think might have happened, you can do the same just as these other opinion pieces have done and flip it and say she was in on it the whole time. She wanted to hold on to her power. She had a big role in the Lamanites pursuing the Nephites. And yeah, I mean, you could read it that way, but there are so few women that show up in the Book of Mormon. I do feel like as a feminist podcast, we have a responsibility to read and interpret them in the most compassionate and loving light, because the majority of their stories are not included in the text. And when they are, I think we should try our best to push past the interpretation that's given to us. And perhaps here the interpretation that's given to us is either she was dumb and she didn't know Amalekiah was a bad guy, or she was like in on it the whole time and was kind of evil. And neither of those are really generous or supportive or compassionate to her position.
And those stem from what? Years of male scholarship in the Book of Mormon.
Right.
And so, yeah, I totally agree with you that it is one, the responsibility, and two, the benefit of coming to the text as a feminist reader to say, okay, hang on, like maybe this could have been differently. Based on my lived experience as a woman, I think this actually might have looked different. Mm-hmm. And lived experience is a valuable way to interpret scripture.
Yes, absolutely.
So the next significant woman that we see show up in the text is the maidservant of Morianton. And we find her in Alma chapter 50, verses 30 through 31.
And this, so Morianton and Morianton's people live in the land of Morianton, and they are Nephites, but what ends up happening is that the people of Morianton kind of go to, it says there's warm contention, and then they end up fighting their own people that live across the way in another land. And the people of Lehi, who the people of Morianton are fighting, they end up running to Moroni, and they say, hello, like all of these people are coming against us. And the people of Morianton fear that Moroni's army is going to come against them. So the people of Morianton, they want to flee northward and basically try and get more of the Nephites on their side, thus creating a division among the Nephites. And this is a big deal because a few chapters ago, the Nephites had entered into a covenant to remain righteous. And if they continued to remain righteous, they would be blessed and they would prosper and there would be no curse on the land. But if they were unrighteous, which I think going to war against your own people and stirring up dissension and killing people definitely counts as unrighteous, that means that the Nephites wouldn't prosper and that the land would be cursed. So there is a lot at stake here, especially for Moroni and Teancum, who are kind of trying to keep everything at bay, not just among the Nephites, but between the Nephites and the Lamanites. And so Morianton, he has a maidservant, and in chapter 50, verses 30 and 31, this is where we see her show up. It says that Morianton is a man of much passion, or I think that is way too nice considering that he ends up beating her. I would say he is a violent abuser. Mm-hmm. So he beats this maidservant because he's upset. She ends up running away from the people of Morianton, and she comes into Moroni's camp, and she tells Moroni everything that the people of Morianton are planning to do. She tells them that they're planning to flee north, that they are planning to continue this type of dissension and violence amongst their own people. And so it's her action, it's her courage, not just from escaping a violent, I wouldn't even say relationship, like a violent work relationship, and choosing to use her voice to stand up for her people and ultimately not just protect herself, but going to Moroni and saying, things are going to get bad between our own people if we don't put an end to this.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I find significant in the text is that in verse 31, it says, after she fled, she, quote, told Moroni all things concerning the matter, comma, and also concerning their intentions to flee into the land northward. I feel like the text is trying to bring our attention to the fact that the maidservant felt comfortable telling Moroni what actually happened to her, what Morianton did to her.
Right.
And also all of his dirty, naughty plans to, like, be a bad boy. And so I find this really touching again in the text, just that this woman felt, I don't know, the circumstances could have been anything, desperate for protection. She must have at least in some measure, like, trusted or hoped that she would be met with at least kindness or understanding or the bare minimum respect, right? But the second thing that I find striking about this is that they actually believed her.
Yeah, like, that's a great point.
They, like, Moroni took everything that she said, believed it as fact, and acted on it. And so I find this awesome. Like, awesome. If I feel like this never happens, not even in real life, right?
Right.
Like, how many women come forward with allegations of abuse or assault and are not believed? Like, it happens literally every day. It's happened to me. It's happened to people that I love. And it's really, really sad. And so I think it's really significant here and exciting that we see a case right in our sacred text of a man taking allegations of abuse and assault seriously and acting upon the information that a woman gives him. So even though it's just one verse, right? It's two verses in the text. I feel like they're really significant, especially for anyone who's survived any type of domestic violence or sexual assault or anything. So yay, Moroni, you actually did the right thing.
Yeah, and it further aligns, or it further reinforces what Moroni and his people have been claiming that they are fighting for, right? You can't just say that you are fighting for the freedom and liberty of your women and children and then not believe a woman when she comes to you and says, this has been my experience, this is how I was abused, and this is what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like there is an alignment between what the people of Moroni say that they're fighting for and what they actually show up and do.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't picked up on that. But it is exciting, and it's good to see, because I feel like, and this might come off as bitter, I don't really care. but, like, I feel like in the church, we claim that we care about women and we care about their health and we care about their well-being. But if they come forward and say, hey, this is not working out for me, like, I'm being abused by an ecclesiastical leader, I'm being abused by a priesthood holder, I don't feel like my voice or role in the church has equal weight or in the family, and the church is just like, obviously, you're not doing a good enough job of being a woman. It's a problem with you, not a problem with us. And so I think there's a lot that we as individuals can learn, but also a system can learn from the text. Like, believe women. It's not that hard. Most of the time, it's a huge risk for women to come forward with any kind of personal experience that is a dissension from, like, the societal norm or what the expectation is. And so, like, she most often does so at great risk to herself. And so I think the very least we can do is afford her the benefit of the doubt and just believe what she says. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes, yes.
And I loved what you said, Elise, about there being an alignment between what the Nephite community claims that they are working toward and the actions that they take toward it. And I think you picked up on another significant theme in the text, which is liberty.
Yes, liberty plays a pretty significant role in the entirety of these chapters. And in chapter 43, verses 45 and 46, this is where the Nephites clearly lay out what they are fighting for. It says they were inspired by a better cause, for they were not fighting for monarchy or power, but they were fighting for their homes and their liberties and their wives and their children. And they were fighting for all, yea, for the rights of worship and their church. And they were doing that which they felt was the duty which they owed to their God. Liberty here means freedom to do as one chooses, free choice. And as feminists and people who care about equality and social justice, the freedom to do as one chooses is an important part of what it means to be in the world. Now, but this doesn't just mean like you get to do whatever you want. You don't just get to be reckless and you don't just get to like say, well, I have the freedom to do whatever I please, no matter who it hurts. It's not that. I don't think that it's just a reckless do whatever you want type of freedom. But what do you think, Channing?
Yeah, I don't think it's that either, right? Like, I think a lot of people are like, they hear like, oh, it's the freedom to do whatever you want. And they will read that as like, oh yeah, I get to do whatever the heck I want. Like, what kind of setup is that? Like, anarchy? And I think a lot of people like are relying a little bit like on rules or framework to like hold people accountable. And I think that that's important too. But I think the freedom to choose is important because the actual choice is what brings us progress if we get to choose. There's a big difference between saying, you know what, I choose to do this thing because I know that it's going to make me a better person or improve my community or improve this relationship versus, oh, I know I should do that, so I guess I'll do it because I have to do it. And I feel like one brings individual growth and change and progress and actually benefits us. And the other is just this like compulsory obligation that we do because like people are shoulding all over us, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're like, you should do this and you should do that. And a good person does all these things. Like there's a difference and it's subtle, but it's important. And that's the kind of freedom that I feel like feminism and anti-racism and anti-colonialism and all of the other isms are asking for is this freedom, not complete anarchy where like Korihor says, whatever a man doeth is no crime. Like that's not what they're asking for. What they're asking for is the opportunity and ability to make the choice that will bring them the most growth and the most progress and the most healing. That's what I think.
I think you are like spot on. And I also think in this way, free will is not just an isolated individual choice. You can't only decide what you think is best for you as a standalone, isolated person. Mm-hmm. I think a responsible use of freedom is to make sure that everyone has it and to make sure that you're using your freedom of choice to allow for everyone to step into freedom, to step into their full being. So that means that you look outward and look toward the needs of your community. And this is one thing that I think is really striking about these chapters and the way that the Nephites, they're reluctant to go to battle. They don't want to be fighting the Lamanites because they see the Lamanites as their family. They realize that war is not the best option for the good of the whole. time and time again, whenever the Nephites and the Lamanites come up to war against each other and the Nephites have the upper hand, they say, please just stop coming against us. Promise you'll never come against us again and we'll let you go. Like, we do not delight in the shedding of blood. We don't want to be against you. We just want to live peaceably and we want everyone, even you, our enemy, to have freedom. But it's not freedom to come and attack us. It's not freedom to oppress us and put us into bondage. I think it's freedom to live a good life and to have the resources and the opportunities and the ability to move throughout the world without bondage.
I'm getting the tinglies when you're talking about that.
Thanks.
Literally, I'm getting goosebumps. I'm like, Elise, mic drop. But don't actually drop your mic because these are expensive.
Yeah, $35. When I had first come to these chapters, I was like, oh, why war? Why are these people fighting?
Again.
Right. Why? Yeah, exactly. Why are they fighting again? But one thing that I've learned and that I believe is that God takes the side of the oppressed. And the people that are oppressed here, at least in the way that the story is presenting it to us, are the Nephites. They're the ones whose lives are at stake. They're the ones who are continually threatened. The Lamanites continually want to take them captive, to have power and control over them, and to put heavy burdens on their back and put them into bondage. And I do believe that God takes the side of the oppressed. And that's what's happening here too, because I think that God sees freedom as an intrinsic human value. And when that freedom is threatened, lost, or obscured, it requires liberation at any price. So for the Nephites, what's the other option when the Lamanites are continually coming against them? They can't lay down. They will be slaughtered or they'll be taken captive. They have to fight because the system is already so violent. The Lamanites are already forcing violence upon them.
Well, and I think too, I actually just literally something that I hadn't thought of yet so far.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we spend so much time looking at why did the Nephites make this choice to go to war? Why did the anti-Nephi Lehis decide not to go to war? And I feel like maybe you and I have been looking at this kind of one-sidedly by not holding the Lamanites accountable.
Nice, like, yeah.
Why the heck are you guys doing this again? Yeah. Like, did – and so I think – maybe that's kind of like my knee-jerk reaction to look at like people who are being threatened with violence. Like, don't you know that Martin Luther King Jr. said, like, do not return violence with violence. Like, hate just spreads more hate, right? But like, it is the responsibility of the people who are instigating the violence. I feel like they need to hold more weight and responsibility for the actions that they instigated. And yes. I feel like I've kind of been looking, me personally, I've been looking at it one-sided, kind of blaming the Nephites, like, oh, you could have done something differently. Why did you do this? When really, like, some critique does, not some, most of the critique needs to fall on the Lamanites because they're the ones that are actually instigating the violence in the first place, most of the time.
Exactly. And the Nephites wouldn't have to respond with violence if there wasn't violence coming against them.
Right.
And I think this is something that we saw a lot with the Black Lives Matter protests. People would say, like, well, why can't we all just get along? But that comment, just like you're pointing out, was only ever directed to the protesters, not to the police officers that were murdering all of these people. So it's that twisting of how freedom gets understood today, I think, at least.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure, too.
As we continue to come upon war chapters in the Book of Mormon and in all of our other sacred text, there's a really great passage that I try and keep in mind as I remind myself that God is always on the side of the oppressed and God is a liberator. And this is a passage from Severino J. Corrado, and he writes, "A God of peace is first of all a God of justice and freedom. Peace is sinful when it serves to maintain injustice and dependence." So God is in that title of liberty, and God always sides with the oppressed and will do anything to move out of injustice and into freedom.
Something else that I also thought was significant as Elise and I were reading through the text was how often the earth shows up again in these chapters. And this is something that we've talked about in past episodes, and I always try to come to the text with an ecofeminist lens as well, which means that not only am I looking for the ways that women show up in the text, but I'm also looking for ways that the earth or the land shows up in the text too. And the reason I thought this was significant was because, one, it shows up in ways that are similar to the ways that's shown up in the past. And two, it's mentioned a lot. Like, I think I have 8 bullet points here talking about specific incidents where the land is mentioned. So I just kind of want to cover those really quick. One thing that I thought was significant was this battle happens at the same place the last major Nephite versus Lamanite battle took place, which was at the river Sidon. And what I also found incredibly interesting was that the verses in these chapters, which is chapter 44, verses 21 and 22, are almost the exact same as the verses earlier in Alma talking about the earlier battles. In chapter 44, verse 21 through 22, it says, "The number of their dead was not numbered because of the greatness of the number. And it came to pass that they did cast their dead into the waters of Sidon, and they have gone forth and are buried in the depths of the sea." And in Alma, chapter 3, verse 3, when the Nephites and Lamanites went to battle, that verse says, "In that battle, as many who had been slain upon the bank of the river were cast into the waters of Sidon. And behold, their bones are in the depths of the sea, and they are many." And so I just find this so interesting that this portion of land is again the site of such significant bloodshed, and that the bodies literally get cast into the sea, as if like the land is just like these people's graveyard slash dumping ground for like all of the horrific things that have happened on the banks of the river Sidon. So I am sad reading this part in the text, but there's not even a but. I'm just sad because it's awful. And this connection between war and the land that it takes place on actually stems from a lot of the work of Rosemary Radford Ruther. She talks a lot about how militarism and war is actually not just violence against humans, but it's also violence against the land. And so I just find it interesting, and I think it's especially noteworthy as we come to these chapters that consist of so much war. We often only think about what the violence is to humans, but as an ecofeminist, I'm also acutely aware of what the violence is to the land. Just something to keep in mind. Other cool things that they mention in the text that refer to the earth is in Alma chapter 45, Moroni and Alma both place a curse and a blessing upon the land, and it's based on righteousness. And also, Elise and I loved this verse in Alma chapter 46, verse 40. At the very end of the chapter, like the whole chapter was like, okay, now there's peace in the land, everything's good. And also, a whole bunch of people started getting sick and fevers because of the climate. But don't worry, there were actually plants that like helped heal their fevers. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so cool. Yay. Like nature's medicine. Isn't she awesome? Like God must have planned that because she's pretty great. So thanks for being a little bit nerdy with me about ecofeminism and the way that it shows up in the text, because I just get excited about it. And when it shows up so many times, I feel like we just have to talk about it because Mother Nature is pretty cool. So as we wrap these chapters up, we also want to say goodbye to Alma, because we've said goodbye to all the other prophets in the Book of Mormon that we've come across so far, but Alma's goodbye in the Book of Mormon is pretty unique, and Elise and I both were a little surprised when we came across it this time.
Yeah, because all of a sudden Alma's, I don't know, talking to his sons again or preaching. And then the chapters just say, basically, he was never heard from again. And the chapter heading and most interpretations of his disappearance just assume like, he was probably translated unto God. And Channing and I are like, what? Like, that seems wild, because if either of us went missing or we just disappeared and no one ever heard from us again, literally no one would assume that I had been translated unto God.
Right. Well, and they are probably like, oh, he probably was really old at this point, right? And he kind of did say, like, do a little goodbye thing to his sons in last week's episode that Elise, you had to do all by yourself. But, like, the fact that he just, like, disappeared and everyone's like, hey, where did Alma go? And the other person's like, I don't know. He probably got translated. And they're probably like, huh, cool joke, bro. And then no one ever actually went and looked for him.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, for people to assume that he did get translated, like, does show that, you know, everyone thinks he's just so amazing and could immediately just go and dwell with God, which is fantastic. And I'm not saying it didn't happen, but it's just a strange way for him to go. Right. Not that it's strange that he might have been translated, but it's just that no one ever heard from him again.
Mormon probably was like, no one said anything about this. Like, I guess I just have to make it up as I go. I don't know. Like, weirder things have happened in the text.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But whatever happened with Alma, we appreciate him for the fantastic things he's done and the stories he's shared with us, and for the ways that he's tried to repair his past wrongdoings.
Yeah, in all reality, he was a pretty good guy. He tried really hard, and I give him an A for effort. So with all of this said, and I know that this has been kind of a lighthearted episode, which probably stands in big contrast to the content that we actually covered today, but we really are so glad that we get to share this time with you and talk about the scriptures and feminism and all the things we just love, and we're really honored to share this space with you. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. Bye!